Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey. What is up, you guys? Thank you so much for joining me on another week of the podcast. So every week, I think about why I do what I do. What is really driving this fire burning within me to make these podcasts, to share this information, to write the newsletter, which you can subscribe to at heartandsoilsupplements.com. And I am constantly reminded of this as I am answering emails that you guys are sending me through Heart and Soil. As you all know, Heart and Soil is the new desiccated organ supplement that I have launched. It is my passion project. And if you send me an email at drpaul@heartandsoilsupplements.com, I will get back to you usually within a day. But as I'm answering your emails, I get so many folks telling me that their physicians are expressing to them that red meat is harmful for a myriad of conditions. I've heard red meat is harmful for psoriasis. Red meat is harmful for diverticulitis. Red meat is harmful for heart disease. Red meat is harmful for cancer. Red meat is harmful for eczema. Red meat is harmful for all kinds of things, rheumatoid arthritis, constipation, IBD, Crohn's, IBS, et cetera, et cetera. And it says to me, it really, really highlights to me why I do what I do, which is to really seek out the truth, to help us understand, to help us remember, as I believe most of you do, that red meat and organs, eating nose to tail, these are the most nutritionally dense foods on the planet. These are the foods that have allowed our ancestors to thrive. And I cannot believe that our mainstream medical establishment, our mainstream media are so misled. There is so much misinformation that it feels incredibly meaningful to me to be someone that is trying to share truth, trying to share ancestral truths, trying to share evolutionarily consistent ideas of the way that humans have eaten for millions of years that has allowed us to thrive. If you've read my book, The Carnivore Code, you know that all of these ideas are in there. But when physicians are telling patients, maybe some of you, that red meat is not good for you for condition X, Y, or Z, I'm thinking to myself, what in the heck is that based on? Because I have never seen an interventional trial to show that. It must be based on misleading epidemiology. But everyone that I know, and all of you sending me these emails, and I so appreciate you reaching out and sharing your stories, over and over, hundreds, thousands of times now, I've heard stories of people thriving eating nose to tail, including organs in their diet, including red meat in their diet, including these most nutrient-rich foods on the planet in their diet, contrary to medical advice, and absolutely thriving. I am thriving. My family is thriving. My niece and nephew, my sister. I'm hoping to get my parents doing more of this. But this is the truth. And this is our ancestral evolutionary truth. And it breaks my heart that we're being so misled. And so this is why I do what I do. To counter the lies with truth, to bring this to light, to remind us of our ancestral birthright, and to help us all sort of reclaim that ancestral birthright to radical health that we all deserve. And I really, truly believe that is by eating nose to tail. And so, as I mentioned earlier, a huge part of that for me is this podcast, my book, and now Heart and Soil. So I hope you'll check us out at heartandsoilsupplements.com. You can always send me an email, drpaul@heartandsoilsupplements.com if you have questions. We have bone marrow and liver supplement. We have a beef organ supplement. We have blood builder and fire starter supplements coming very soon. Fire starter is a high stearic acid tallow. And I've talked about stearic acid recently on the podcast as a substance, as a signaling 18-carbon saturated fatty acid that turns on mitochondrial fat burning. I'm super excited about all these supplements. Firestarter, we've gotten a lot of interest in. Bone marrow and liver, beef organs are available now, and the feedback is fantastic, you guys. I am so excited to share these with you, and I hope you will check them out. You can use the code CarnivoreMD at the website for 10% off your first order. Thank you so much for being part of my tribe and listening to this podcast. I hope that if you enjoy this podcast, you will leave me a review on iTunes. It is how we reach more people. If you've read my book and you enjoy it, please leave me a review on Amazon. There are lots of troll reviews out there now. People just don't like it because they're vegans or whatever. And it's important that those of you that enjoy the book share your voice as well, both on iTunes and on Amazon, because ultimately the reason I do this And the reason I hope that many of you listen is because we believe this is how we will get back our ancestral birthright to radical health. And this is how we help other people in our lives live fully as well. So thank you for being in this with me. Thank you for sharing the message. Thank you for sharing my podcast. I think you will really enjoy this one with Vincent Pedre. I always get requests on the podcast to have guests on who think differently than I do. And so this is one of those. Dr. Vincent Pedre is a mainstream physician. He's an MD. He practices in New York. And he's written a book about fiber and the microbiome and how important it is to get fiber and plant fiber for the microbiome. And so I wanted to have him on the podcast for a very friendly debate about fiber and the microbiome, the need for human to have fiber for the microbiome. And as you'll hear, I counter many of his points with evidence. This is similar evidence to what's in the book. And I think that you will find this one very interesting. As you all know, my strong position is that humans do not need plant fiber for a healthy microbiome in any way, shape, or form. You may have also seen on Instagram and social media that my own alpha diversity, which I tested through Longevity, is massively high. It's 94 out of 100, which means I have a more diverse gut than 94% of people tested. I'm higher than most vegans out there. I challenge any vegan to beat me in terms of alpha diversity. It's not about plant fiber for alpha diversity. It's not about plant fiber for healthy gut. I actually believe that it's mostly about linoleic acid and eating an evolutionarily consistent diet that is free from as many plant toxins as possible and full of as many nose-to-tail nutrients as you can get. So enjoy this one with Dr. Vincent Pedre. I so appreciate my other sponsors as well, Blue Box, BLUBLOX.com. These guys are making super high-quality blue-blocking glasses. As you will hear in this podcast, circadian rhythm is super important for our microbiome. And one of the ways that I protect it is by wearing blue blocking glasses, the ones from Blue Box, because those are my favorite. I use the Jaspers. They look really cool. I look like an erudite hipster when I'm out at night in blue light or bright light. And these protect my circadian rhythm by shielding my eyes from the blue light. So I really dig them. You can use the code CARNIVOREMD at blueblocks.com for 15% off your order. They've also got what I think is the best sleep mask out there. So check out the Blue Blocks sleep mask as well. It, as I've said before, as I've joked about, it doubles as a bug costume for Halloween, which is rapidly approaching. And I so hope Halloween doesn't get canceled as well, because that's my favorite holiday. So White Oak Pastures is another sponsor that I deeply appreciate. WhiteOakPastures.com. Sixth generation farm, 150 years in the Harris family. They've been doing regenerative agriculture for 20 years. You can see graphics in my book, The Carnivore Code, and other places about how the soil at White Oak Pastures is enriched with carbon over time, because the ecosystems-based approach of regenerative agriculture is sequestering carbon into the soil. This is what creates healthy soils and allows humans to live on the land. One of my favorite quotes that I have on the Heart and Soul website is essentially that the land does not belong to us. We belong to the land. We will return to the land. Our bones, our blood, it will all return to the land. We belong to the land. If we do not care for the land, we will perish. And regenerative agriculture, the kind that we are supporting at Heart and Soil, the kind that is done at White Oak Pastures, is how we cherish the land, how we respect the land, how we respect our animals. And it is how we really ensure our future generations will have a healthy planet to live on. You can use the code CARNIVOREMD at White Oak Pastures for 10% off your first order. They are also doing a loyalty program, which allows you to be in line should the food system collapse. And I think this is a great idea. There's a lot of concern now about shaky food systems, collapsing food systems, and you will be, I believe, insured a source of meat and organs and good food from White Oak Pastures when you support them through the loyalty program. They've made me a mayor of Bluffton, Georgia, which is one of the upper echelons of the loyalty program, and I couldn't be more proud of that designation. So that is something I think is amazing. White Oak is amazing. WhiteOakPastures.com. I also want to give a shout out to Nutrisense.io. These guys are amazing. They are doing the CGMs. You can listen to the CGM podcast, the Continuous Glucose Monitor podcast that I did with them, and see that it's so fascinating. There's so much information that can be gleaned by knowing your blood sugar 24 hours a day. I can't wait for my dad to wear this. I really think it's going to help him change behavior. You can let them know Carnivore MD sent you at NutriSense, but I think it is a very worthwhile investment. There's so much debate now about honey, but I can tell you very clearly, carbohydrates do not cause diabetes. My CGM proves it. My blood work, which I will talk about in a future podcast, proves it. My fasting insulin is less than 3 micro IU per ml. So I am not insulin resistant eating honey, you guys. Carbohydrates don't cause insulin resistance. This is wrong. and you can prove that with a CGM like I did, you can actually see what your glycemic variability is. And if you don't know how insulin sensitive you are, a CGM will tell you. If you wonder how you respond to foods, a CGM will tell you. It is such a valuable intervention. Last shout out goes to my friends at Force of Nature, forceofnaturemeats.com. These guys are also doing regenerative agriculture raised meats, buffalo, Oregon blends. I love these guys. Check them out. They are fantastic folks. Without further ado, on to the podcast. Listen after for what is going on with me as always. All right. Welcome to the podcast, my friend. It's good to connect with you. We have not connected before, but I think that there's going to be a lot of fun stuff that comes out of this conversation. So thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
Even before we pressed record, I was like, oh, we got to press record because we were having all these little good snippets of good stuff coming. And I have gotten lots of requests from people to have folks on the podcast that have differing opinions. And I think you and I will agree on a lot of things, and we may disagree a little bit on fiber. And I think that will be a good discourse. So this will be kind of fun. But why don't we start out the podcast with a little bit of your background, and then let's jump in from there into sourcing and where our food is coming from. But tell us a little bit where you are, because we were just chatting about New York City and you said it's 40 degrees there, and I'm in sunny
California. I've lived here for 20 years, which is pretty crazy that it just feels like it went by in a blip of an eye. But it's really been an amazing place to develop my career. I had gone to University of Miami School of Medicine on scholarship. And when I was finishing there, I could have easily stayed in Miami, which was my hometown. And I just knew that if I was going to grow, that I needed to leave my comfort zone. And I needed to leave Miami, which is where my family was. And I've always been kind of one that if you met me, like you'd see, maybe I'm not as shy as I used to be at that age. But I'm kind of one of those extroverted introverts, you know, that I can put it on if I need to, but the way I recharge is, we were talking about this, like for me, it's going out in nature, doing stuff on my own, like going on a run by myself is like perfect recharge for me. Here in New York, I do it on the East River, and I take a pedestrian bridge to Randall's Island. A lot of people don't even realize you can take a pedestrian bridge to an island right off of Manhattan, and it's beautiful because then you're on the other side looking at all the crazy buildings. But I came to New York and did my residency training here because I just thought if there was anywhere that I was going to get the best training possible was New York City, with all the people from all over the world and international. And I worked at Elmhurst Hospital during my residency for parts of it. And if I don't know if you know Elmhurst, New York in Queens, but it is considered one of the most, if not the most diverse neighborhood per square mile of any part of this country, like the amount of different cultures that you have living together. So it was an incredible experience because, I mean, constantly calling for Chinese interpreter, Spanish interpreter, Korean interpreter. Well, I didn't need a Spanish interpreter because I'm fluent bilingual. So it was a benefit, but that's what got me to New York. And I don't know. I know we're going to dive into some juicy stuff. So I'll let you ask me any questions, or like if you want to know more about my history, how I got to this place.
Well, you've already said the word diversity. I think diversity is going to come up a lot today because it's kind of a buzzword right now. We'll get to that eventually. We're probably going to talk about alpha diversity, maybe a little bit about beta diversity and the microbiome. But as you're saying, as you're describing the juxtaposition between the urban environment of New York City and the perhaps more rural or even undeveloped environment of Randall Island, I'm thinking like, oh, this is great. This is totally tying in with all we're talking about. You can think about all the things you're getting exposed to in the city that might affect your microbiome versus in a less developed environment. So,
or even like the lack of diversity, you know, because you're basically walking in a concrete jungle.
Right.
But you don't have the richness of diversity that you get by being in contact with nature and with soil.
And yes. And so you're talking now the diversity of organisms that we're being exposed to all the time. And many of my listeners may be aware of this, but we could even talk about this a little bit. The fact that we can affect the microbiome is a big term, right? It's a skin microbiome. It's an oropharyngeal microbiome. It's a
Yeah.
It's a gastrointestinal microbiome. You know, it's everywhere. And we can affect, and it's all kind of continuous, and we can affect that just by being in a different setting. You know, your microbiome.
There are many things that can affect it. And actually, you might find this really fascinating. So like, even if you look at your hand and you look at the creases in your hand, and the space between the creases are actually like deserts almost. There's hardly any bacteria there. And then you get to a crease and they're teeming with bacteria. Huh. So, and I thought that's really fascinating because basically, yeah, you described it. There are all these different zones that bacteria live in and on our body. And depending on the zones, you can almost think of it as different climate zones. There's going to be different types of bacteria that predominate inside the airway versus on your skin versus inside your mouth versus in your gut. And of course, when we talk about microbiome, a lot of people are thinking, you know, we're talking about the gut. But the reason for that, it's the biggest reservoir of the microbiome. But you can't forget that there are many microbiomes in the body, including in the respiratory system, that are extremely important. It's just that the gut microbiome is the one that has probably, it's almost like that movie. I don't know if, did you ever see that movie? And I forget the Disney movie where there were all these little people inside a machine and they were actually controlling the people. They were like in the brain.
I'm trying to think. What movie is it?
I'm trying to think of what that movie was. But
was it
it's
Wally?
Almost like you think like we think we're in charge.
Yeah.
But it's really the microbiome is in charge. And I've heard some people say, and I think it's kind of jokingly, that we're basically reproductive organs or organisms for the microbiome.
We're just here
to make sure that the microbiome survives.
and I think that many listeners will know that the microbiome outnumbers us, and the exact scale of that is debated. It seems to change every year or so by how much they outnumber us. But
in the billions, maybe up to the trillions.
Yeah.
But it's high up there. I mean, the amount that lives in the large intestine is pretty. I mean, let's put it in this perspective. There are 400 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. You have more bacteria in your gut than there are stars in the Milky Way.
Yeah, the numbers I've seen are 10 to the 15th, 10 to the 16th, and those are at least an order of magnitude greater than the number of human cells in our body, so that we are more.
Yeah.
In some ways, we are more.
We are more microbe than we are human, if you start thinking about it. And what's even crazier is that the DNA, so the collective DNA blueprint of the microbiome is 100 times more than our own DNA. And there are people who will argue that you cannot fulfill all of the biological processes that the body has to, that needs in order to survive, would not be able to be fulfilled without the microbiome. And that's talking about, you know, we talk about microbiome, then there's this whole other topic of the metabolome, which is all the metabolic products that the microbiome produces and how that affects us, from neurotransmitters like GABA, serotonin, dopamine, to producing vitamins like vitamin B12 and vitamin K. When you start thinking about it, it's quite interesting, because then you wonder, you know, how should we be eating in a way that supports our microbiome? And I know we're gonna get into it a little bit.
We will.
About that.
I think we definitely should be eating in a way that supports our microbiome. And there may be variable opinions about how to do that.
Yeah.
But first, let's talk about soil, because I am fascinated by soil and the environment. And I'm thinking about you running on Randall Island, or me being in the ocean, or me being in the forest, or me, you know, being in the mountains. And we kind of alluded to this earlier, that the environment that we're in, whether it's indoors or in a city or in a natural setting, can affect our microbiome. So
how does
the health of the soil or the quality of the natural environment that we're in affect us in terms of a microbial perspective?
Let me start by saying this, just to put it into perspective. 25% of the biodiversity on the earth is found in the soil. Like, just think about that for a moment. 25% of the biodiversity of life is actually in the soil. And modern farming practices are killing that biodiversity through the use of pesticides, through, and I'm going to say also through the use of genetically modified organisms. It's not that, you know, some of these are made to resist. So there's different types of genetic modifications that can be done to plants. One of them, and the primary one, is to make them resistant to a pesticide that then kills weeds instead. But the other modification is that they produce their own pesticide. So they actually found a bacteria that's in the soil. It's called Bacillus thuringiensis that produces something called BT toxin, which is just the first and last name of the bacteria, which is genus species, and their toxin. And that toxin pokes holes inside the lining of the digestive tract of insects, so it kills them. So that's one way that they do it, but the majority of it is actually made resistant to the pesticide. And the one that we probably everyone's heard, Roundup, or the active ingredient is glyphosate. And what they found is that farmers who are using glyphosate on GMO crop will use 6 times as much pesticide as they would have before, because they're encouraged, like, oh, you can just use as much pesticide as you want. It's going, you know, your crop is going to survive. Just kill those damn weeds. And the crazy thing is that glyphosate, if you look at the molecular structure of glyphosate, it is a chelator. So it's basically designed to bind minerals. Well, guess where that glyphosate is going? It's seeping into the soil. And it's also starving the microbiome in the soil. And that what they found is that when that you look at fields where glyphosate has been used over and over, you start seeing a shift in the soil microbiome, and you start seeing some very unfavorable bacteria start to grow in that soil. And you think, like, things evolved over time. Our plants evolved to live on a certain type of soil in this very interdependent ecosystem that not only is interdependent, but it also produces the best product. Because we cannot out-engineer nature. You know, as much as we want to, we cannot out-engineer nature. We can improve upon it through certain things. I don't know. I don't know if you watched this documentary. It was produced by partly directed by a friend of mine, Rob Herring. It's called The Need to Grow.
I haven't seen it.
And it's basically about how if we continue at the rate that we're going to lose all of our farmable soil before the end of the first century of the 2000s. So basically, we've got like 65 years left of farmable soil. The incredible thing, though, is that you can actually rehabilitate soil. I mean, a living soil, like a soil that is vibrant and supporting the best nutrition for the plants that are growing on it, is going to be teeming with earthworms. It's going to be teeming with microorganisms. And that is a soil that supports a nutrient-dense plant. So for me, very important, you know, and we talk about like where our food comes from and what we're growing. I mean, there's so many ramifications to this, but even this is a crazy idea if we're thinking about sustainability. And if you believe in climate change, I don't know if you do or your listeners where they lie upon that.
Well, I definitely believe in climate change.
That climate change argument.
Yeah.
I do believe that climate change exists and that we are in, definitely in a cycle that's been accelerated by humans. The crazy thing is that if we rehabilitated our soil, the soil traps carbon dioxide.
Of course.
So we have kind of a means to reverse climate change just by making our soil healthier. And that would mean, you know, using less pesticide, which, by the way, I don't know if you've ever looked at a map of the United States, and I don't know, have you ever seen the CDC dated maps of obesity trends in the US over time?
Yeah.
Since the 1970s? If you overlay that map with where pesticides are being sprayed in our country, you'll see that the obesity epidemic began in sort of like the Midwestern belt all the way down to like Arkansas, Mississippi. And that also happens to be one of the biggest areas where pesticides are used. And then that started spreading, I think, because of everything that's happened with our food supply and toxins and toxicity and people eating too many packaged foods and crap.
I couldn't agree more. I think that the what you highlighted there about monocrop agriculture is something that I've talked about multiple times. When we grow plants one crop at a time on soil and we till the soil, we aerate the soil. And that causes the upper layers to oxidize and it causes loss of nutrients in the soil. And the soil layers basically erode and are washed off into lakes and rivers, causing, you know, disruption of other ecosystems. And so monocrop plant agriculture is a scourge on this planet. And the only way that we are going to be able to regenerate the soil is by creating ecosystems again. And that's kind of what we see in the natural world, right? And that's why you can go out to the dirt. And when I was in the Pacific Northwest doing residency at the University of Washington, I would go into the mountains on the Olympic Peninsula and just stick my hand in the dirt and it was brown, you know? And I was like, yeah. You can tell that this is, there's something magical in there. And I love that you highlighted that 25% of biodiversity is in the soil. And so I always wonder, you know, humans are not even exposed to that type of soil anymore on plants, or they're not eating animals that are feeding on plants that are grown in that soil.
Right.
The other thing I want to highlight in what you said is that the key way that we can regenerate the soil is by putting ruminants on the land. And this is regenerative agriculture. This is the work of Alan Savory. This is White Oak Pastures and many farms now that are doing this type of agriculture where they are moving animals around, not letting them eat the grass all the way to the roots, and they're pooping on the land and all of that organic matter, right?
Oh my poop gosh.
Poop is always the answer, right? Poop is the answer. All of that organic matter is coming into the soil and that is part of the ecosystem and that is how we regenerate it. And as you suggest, that can create increased biodiversity in the soil, increased root systems of plants, and an increased ability of the soil and the root system of plants to sequester carbon dioxide.
I don't know if you heard of this other documentary. I'm going to give you another one to watch if you haven't. But this one actually was started, it's a farm that was started there in outside of Los Angeles, somewhere I think in the mountains. And it's called The Biggest Little Farm.
I heard of this one. I haven't seen it.
It's really amazing, like, to understand the importance of how if you create an ecosystem that is designed to balance itself, that you can actually do that without pesticides. And I mean, here they had bought land. So the guy, I think, is a film producer, Hollywood or something. And they decided they just had this idea. Let's create a farm. And you think, well, that sounds easy. Well, no, that's not very easy, especially if you're in California and the soil is like half dead. So they had to bring in an expert to revitalize the soil. And then they also had to create a water feature so they could kind of balance out the environment. But in the process, they at some point had an imbalance. And I think they were having issues with foxes. And they thought they had to get rid of the foxes. But then they realized that it was all part of this whole ecosystem that just needs the right type of balance. You need the predator for a reason. And it's a really great, I feel like if there's any movie that captures the true spirit of how that entire ecosystem, why you see so many different animals in a farm and how they all kind of support the balance in the ecosystem, it's just super fascinating.
I mean, it's the natural world, right? Like you go out and we're all stuck in cities, and granted, you know, New York is a unique collection of culture, but it's a concrete jungle, my man, you know?
I know. I wish I could show you. I'm in my office, actually. Maybe I can point my computer for a moment and show you out my window here. It's basically concrete. Scaffolding. I'm in a concrete jungle.
I'm so scared. But if you look in the natural world, you know, you on Randall Island or me in the Pacific Northwest and the Olympic Peninsula, it just works. Like ecosystems in the natural world work, and all of this is happening. And so I suspect that a big part of getting humans back to healthy microbiomes, and again, this is a platitude, this is a very broad statement, is going to be helping them reconnect with the natural world and getting more dirt.
I agree. You know? I totally agree.
And so
I completely agree, because I mean, if you think about it, we are carrying, and I like to say, even though I don't know that this is necessarily true, but I do think the gut microbiome is one of the most complex ecosystems on the planet.
Oh yeah.
One of the most complex. Now, if you're listening to this and you just heard this, like, think about that. If you know you are carrying the most complex ecosystem on the planet that has more microbes than there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy, so in many ways, it's your own personal galaxy, how would you take care of it? Now that you know that you have this responsibility, that you're carrying basically a quantum universe inside your body, in your gut, that is communicating with your body and your DNA and interacting and creating all sorts of different metabolic byproducts that affect even your ability to learn and create memory. You know, if you think about that, then how would you treat your body? You know, I just think, like, it's, if you think about it in that way, I mean, if you care about the microbiome, I mean, I care about the microbiome and I care about the planet and the soil. And I think the more we've become, the more technological we've become, and the more, you know, you've seen the trend in the last century, people, more and more people moving into cities. If you look at, you know, for a country like Peru, where I'm going to be going in a couple of weeks to teach, the majority of the people in Peru live around the coast and Lima. And then you have all of this rest of the country that's quite sparse, and it's beautiful. I don't know if you've ever been to Peru, but it's one of my favorite countries. In fact, Peru has has a huge chunk of the biodiversity of the earth in just a very small section of the country, because it goes from the Amazon all the way into the high Andes Mountains. And it's just astounding. I mean, I've done the Inca Trail there, and I've gone hiking from 15,000 feet near a glacier. And in one day, we descended 6,000 feet and went through multiple climate zones. And as we came down, you could see the size of the leaves, which were really tiny, you know, or almost barren on the top of the mountain, but then really tiny leaves. And as you start getting closer and closer down into closer into the tropical rainforest, they start getting bigger until they're like really big. And it's just, in one day, you can see multiple ecosystems just go through, and it's incredible. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you. We need to, and this is why I talk about this, and I get out and I go in nature and I do trips where I get into nature and I go hiking, because I really do think that our connection with the natural world is a big thing that's missing in our modern life, but it's also a big key to how we can be healthy. I mean, we know that if you go out and spend time in a forest, that automatically your cortisol levels will go down. And if you're by a water feature, like a running river or a waterfall, the negative ions just make you feel zen. That's why, you know, you go on a hike and you feel incredible. Well, it's lowering your stress hormones.
This is Shinrin Yoku. This is forest bathing, right? This is what the Japanese call Shinrin Yoku.
Yeah.
And I think I'll piggyback on what you said and say that I think that taking the health of the soil and the health of the land of the earth as a priority is going to be tantamount for humans moving forward. That is going to be one of the single most important things that we need to do as a human species is regenerate the quality of our land. And that only happens by creating ecosystems. And those ecosystems, like regenerative agriculture, will produce the best quality food. And that is what we need. And it makes so much sense, because that is the way that we can reverse climate change, et cetera. But if we ignore the soil and we ignore what we're doing to the soil with pesticides, monocrop agriculture, traditional farming, traditional animal agriculture, we are, like you said, we are dead. We are dead.
When we lose the soil, we're dead. What we do to the soil,
yeah,
we're doing to ourselves.
Yeah.
And what I heard, I forget the name of the guy, but he's the founder of the human, I think it's the Human Longevity Project is the name of it. But he's traveled to Africa and lived with the Hadza people of Tanzania, who are one of the last few hunter-gatherers that we know of. But the really cool thing is that they've tested their gut microbiome.
So is Jeff Leach?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Jeff Leach. Yeah.
Yeah. And I heard him speak and he said something really beautiful, that the microbiome will be the new, his viewpoint is that our understanding of the microbiome is going to basically be the new environmental movement. Because you realize that we're decimating our own microbiome. But what's really fascinating is, have you ever heard of how the traditional hunter-gatherer Hadza, like what their diet is and what their lifestyle is?
I think it's very different now than it was a few hundred years ago.
There is still a small segment of, so there's about a little over 1,000 of them left, and there's still probably 200 or so that still live the traditional hunter-gatherer lifestyle. And they have exceptions, like they can hunt and kill zebra, which is not allowed otherwise, but because it's their, it was just their ancestral, part of their ancestral way. And they're not going out and mass killing animals like humans do. They just, they hunt. But what really struck me is, so he was describing, and he showed pictures of this, he went out on a hunt with one of the hunters and kills a zebra. And he says, right there on the field, opened it, then opened the guts, cut out the stomach and the intestines, cut the stomach, basically squeezed all the contents out of the stomach, and then ate the stomach right after he had just killed the animal, like sushi style.
Talk about diversity.
And their, like, when you look at their microbiome, their microbial diversity, and they did this in comparison to a control group, which was an Italian control group.
Right, right.
You see, like, their microbial diversity is, like, multicolored, and it's, like, this wide. And you look at the Italian group, and it's, like, this wide.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's because, but the crazy thing is, because we do talk a lot, and I still preach a lot about diversity in our food supply. And yet, what are the Hadza eating? Their traditional diet, they're eating small to medium-sized game animals. Zebra would be rare. Then they're eating berries. So the hunters eat berries as they're hunting, just to kind of keep their energy levels up. They're eating honey. But when I heard, I was thinking, okay, part of their seasonal diet is honey, because that's the other thing about their diet. It's seasonal, depending on what's available.
Sure.
But they're eating not honey in the way that we think of it. They're eating the honeycomb with the larva in it. And talk about diversity. But at the same token, it's not like, because for months they might be eating that as one of their primary energy sources, and then they eat a lot of tubers, which are things like root vegetables. Like we think of sweet potato as a tuber. They're eating a lot of tubers. And then the last thing that they eat is the baobab.
Right.
The baobab tree, which is really high in fiber. And actually they use that to wean the kids off of breast milk. They will take the nut of the baobab tree with the meat and the pulp of the fruit, and they grind it all up and make almost like an oatmeal type of porridge. Let's call it a porridge. And that's what they give the children when they're weaning them off of breast milk. And the crazy thing is the kids are eating up to 100 grams of fiber a day. Now, compared to Americans, I know we're going to get into
fiber topic. I'm getting ready, man.
Into a fiber topic.
I'm doing the M&M Americans, over here. I'm ready to
Americans
fight.
Eat like... 10 to 15 grams of fiber per day.
All right. So let's talk about the Hadza. So here's what I would counter that with. What it sounds to me like is that you're making an argument that increased fiber increases diversity. And I see a lot of holes in that argument for a number of reasons. If we look at interventional studies with fiber, they do not increase alpha diversity. And there are numerous studies that show this, that when we give people more fiber, it does not increase alpha diversity. And I'll just back up for the listener and tell them that alpha diversity is an ecological measure of the number of species in a given ecosystem. There's also something called beta diversity, which has to do with how much your one species varies from another in two different ecosystems. But alpha diversity is what we really think of with the gut. And as you're suggesting, populations of hunter-gatherers do appear to have increased levels of alpha diversity relative to urbanites. And this has been attributed to their high fiber, but I think this is a big mistake because the interventional literature suggests no for two in, on both sides of the issue. When we give people more fiber, we do not see alpha diversity increase. And in studies with diets that are zero or low fiber, we do not see alpha diversity decrease. So adding fiber does not increase alpha diversity. Taking fiber away does not decrease alpha diversity. There are studies in people with ketogenic diets. There's even a study on people with carnivore diet that was done at Harvard called Diet Reproducibly Alters the Gut Microbiome that shows no change in the alpha diversity when you remove all fiber. So the argument, this is a very sort of appealing fairy tale argument that the Hadza eat lots of fiber and this is why they have so much microdiversity.
So I think it's I'm going to interrupt for a moment and say that the Hadza, yes, they're eating a lot of fiber and they do eat way more fiber. Even the adults eat like 50 grams a day, but they're also living in a very dirty environment.
Yeah.
So they're intimately like connected to the soil. There's no concept of antibacterial soap or hand sanitizer, none of that. And when the hunter comes back from the hunt and might have blood on their hands, they don't wash their hands before they touch their kids and hug them and stuff, you know. So there's more variables there.
I think that there's also this conflation of ideas in the space. I do not think that an increased variety of foods in our diet, that has not been shown to increase alpha diversity.
That is what I'm saying with the Hadza, because exactly. You know, we all preach, and in functional medicine we talk about eating the rainbow of colors.
Not me.
To get all of the diversity of the different plant phytonutrients.
Oh, you don't want to. That's a whole separate thing. We can go into all.
And you definitely don't want to be like a monocolor eater. You know, like you don't want to be like a carba vegan who's eating bread and pasta, and that's, you know, so you don't want to be all eating just white colored foods. But the thing to think about with the Hadza, and when I first heard this and then saw the data on them, I'm like, you know, we're preaching diversity, but they have more diversity than we do. And their diet is way narrower than the Western diet. You know, they're not eating all these greens and all these different vegetables. But they are intimately connected to the earth.
Yes, they are. And the other thing to note about the Hadza.
That's a huge, huge difference.
The other thing to note about the Hadza, and I've talked about this with paleoanthropologists numerous times on this podcast, is that the way they're living now is even different than they were living 500 or 1,000 years ago because they can't hunt big game. You mentioned this, that they can really only hunt zebra occasionally, and that's only medium-sized game. It's not very high in fat. And so the hypothesis with the Hadza and living hunter-gatherer groups on the planet now that have been studied by Boyd Eaton and Lauren Cordain in the 1980s is that they actually can't get enough fat, and so they have to go to carbohydrates, and they may be driven to more of the plant-based foods. This is sort of a topic for a different podcast.
Yeah, because we know that tubers, for example, are like a big part of their diet.
Right. And the hypothesis there is that may come out of necessity because they can't get big enough, fatty enough animals. What we observe in these hunter-gatherer groups is when they take down a big animal, which is rare, they will just eat that animal. But it's all about that fat, right? Because we know that humans can't run on protein. So if they can get lots of lean animals, it only does them so good. They can get rabbit starvation once they exceed, you know, the urea cycle in the liver to process the nitrogen groups, but they need either carbohydrate or protein. But I do think that, as you're suggesting, there are plenty of examples of people on the planet that have moderate or even, you know, reasonable amounts of carbohydrates in their diet who are very healthy and don't have chronic Western disease. So I've never wanted to argue that carbohydrates in and of themselves in all peoples are dangerous. I think that for a lot of people, maybe in the westernized world with our genetics or our disordered microbiomes, elimination of those can be helpful, but that's a separate conversation. But the Hadza, I mean, what you and I need to do is go to Hadza, go to Tanzania and eat. I want to eat some stomachs, man.
I will connect you. I was just invited to go to Tanzania to spend time with the Hadza by a guy who organizes a trip there. So yeah. We'll chat offline.
Yeah. So if people want to know, the study I was referring to is called The Ketogenic Diet Influences Taxonomic and Functional Composition of the Gut Microbiota in Children with Severe Epilepsy. And again, that one found no decrease in alpha diversity with a very low fiber ketogenic diet. And the other one, which is quite famous, is called Diet Rapidly and Reproducibly Alters the Human Gut Microbiome. That's actually a carnivore study, which is pretty amazing, in 2014, published in Nature. And then the other fascinating thing was a 2018 study published in Frontiers in Microbiology called Reduce Mass and Diversity of the Colonic Microbiome in Patients with Multiple Sclerosis and Their Improvement with a Ketogenic Diet. And that one is really cool because what they found, they followed people with a ketogenic diet who were doing it with multiple sclerosis for 6 months. And for the first few weeks, they found a dip in the diversity, and then it came back and it went higher than baseline. How cool is that? That over time,
it shifted. What type of ketogenic diet was, because there's so many ways to do keto.
Right.
So
I think, yeah,
what type of ketogenic diet was, because you still can have plant fibers in a ketogenic diet.
Yeah, I think this was a pretty low fiber ketogenic diet. I'd have to look and see what the amount of fiber in the diet was. But I think that they were doing such low carbohydrate that they can't do much fiber. They were below 20 grams of carbohydrates a day. So they said 160 grams of fat, less than 100 grams of protein was recommended. Yeah. But they saw this shift and the microbiome changed, the diversity changed, and then it got better. So I think even in the paper, the diet rapidly and reproducibly alters the microbiome, they say the human microbiome is probably it's an organism, right? And it can shift. And when we eat fiber, it can shift in a certain direction. When we don't eat plant fiber, it can shift in a different direction. But what we've seen in the literature is that the alpha diversity doesn't seem to change with or without fiber. So that kind of gets to this question, because a lot of people will point to fiber. But let's keep talking about this. I mean, we can keep doing the point counterpoint. Like how else do you think we should eat and we don't really, this is all sort of, I don't think we really know, how should we eat to really help our microbiome? You kind of suggested an array of colors. I think most of my listeners.
That's a really great question. You know, well, I feel like knowing how, it's not just how you eat, it's how you live.
Okay.
Let's start with that. So it's not just about what foods are coming across the table, but it's really about, you know, are you out getting in nature? You know, do you have a pet, which is a great microbiome diversification device?
That's a fantastic one. Yeah.
Have a dog licking your face. That really helps with your microbial diversity, because they're out in the dirt and who knows, they're getting exposed to a lot of things. But I still do believe that fiber is important in a diet. Now, I think that there's more than one diet that fits for across the spectrum of humanity. But I think as a blanket statement, like, people are eating too many processed carbs, and we know that that's not good for the microbiome.
I would agree with you completely on that.
Too much. What they don't realize is sugar, because a piece of white toast is like 2 teaspoons of sugar, which is basically 8 grams of sugar. But The other thing is that people are also not getting enough healthy fats, you know, in their diet. But we know, okay, so this is where we'll probably differ, because there's also plenty of studies looking at the metabolic byproducts. We know that when you take in fiber, that becomes the food source for the microbiome that uses it to make these byproducts that are called short-chain fatty acids,
right,
that you know about.
Yeah.
And one of the most important ones is butyrate.
Sure.
They make propionate acetate, but butyrate, really important for its effects throughout the entire body. First off, feeding the colon cells. So the cells that line the colon basically fuel on butyrate. So it's quite interesting that they evolved to fuel on something that the microbiome produces rather than glucose, which is what most of the cells in the body use as fuel. But secondly, we know that butyrate crosses the blood-brain barrier, goes to the brain, and affects the histone. I'm going to not remember the name of the enzyme, but it's histone deacetylase.
Yeah.
And by doing that, actually influences gene expression and will trigger brain neurotrophic factor, BDNF, and that will then trigger new neural connections. So quite fascinating that there is this gut-brain connection. And we know that in studies where they've looked at giving inulin, which is a prebiotic fiber, that you can get increases in butyrate-producing organisms in the gut. So I'll differ and say that I do think that some amount of fiber is necessary. I think that there's a lot of people who do wrong diets, or they do extreme diets. Do we need to be getting a huge diverse range in our diet more than just getting the right types of foods?
Or the right type of experiences?
Yeah. I mean, that is the question. Yeah. I mean, also the Hadza would eat all of the organs of the animal.
Yeah. Right? Well, I'm a proponent for that. I'm a huge proponent of that.
And organ meats are incredibly rich in all sorts of essential minerals and vitamins. Like liver is the highest in B12. It's the best source for B12.
It's the best source of so many things. Yeah. Let's talk about the short chain fatty acids, because this comes up a lot for people. So this is really fascinating. Okay. Yes. When we eat plant fiber, we make butyrate. When we don't eat plant fiber, when we eat protein and fat, we can make isobutyrate and acetate and propionate, right? There are good studies which show that isobutyrate can do the exact same thing as butyrate. So what butyrate does, so butyrate is in the colon, right? And it has to go across the epithelial cells. And then butyrate goes through a series of steps and actually becomes beta-hydroxybutyrate, which is used for fuel. So there are two pieces to this equation. So in a state of ketosis, we can actually use beta-hydroxybutyrate from the bloodstream to nourish colonocytes, and we don't need butyrate from the inside of the gut, which is probably why ketogenic diets are so valuable for people who have disordered gut problems, because we know that in overgrowth of hydrogen sulfide...
And brain issues.
Yeah. And yeah. When there's overgrowth of hydrogen sulfide-producing organisms, we can't oxidize butyrate and get it across the colonic epithelial lining. So there's some evidence that if someone has a disordered gut microbiome in the colon, we can't actually use butyrate from the colon. We have to get it in the circulation, in which case we'd want to get it as a ketone.
So, and we're also talking about, you know, we're talking about a lot about the, you know, these different short chain fatty acids. In the Hadza people, when they looked at that, they actually had higher propionate than butyrate, which I thought in the stool, which I thought was really fascinating, because we also know, like and I'm not an autism expert, but that in autistic children, you might see really low butyrate and you might see a high acetate, which is considered inflammatory. And I know I've read about propionate, and it seems like there's controversy over whether it is inflammatory if it's not. Obviously, for the Hadza, high propionate is really not having an adverse effect. So you know, so the good questions here. I mean, the other thing is how they measure the, you know, the alpha change, you know, what type of stool analysis are they doing?
In the studies that I was talking about earlier, I'd have to go back and look.
That's always a question, is what type of technology are they using?
I think they're usually using quantitative PCR or 16S, you know.
Yeah, RNA-seq. I mean, but if it's, you know, so if it's 16S versus whole genome analysis, there's certain limits to 16S analysis because they can only analyze for about 10,000 different species.
But there's a control group. I mean, they have groups where they're feeding lots of fiber and no fiber, and they're looking for changes in alpha diversity. I think that in terms of gut testing, metabolomics, you know, and whole genome is the way to go, like a periomics might do in the future. But so going back to the short chain fatty acids, what's so cool is that, so in the gut, butyrate stimulates a number of receptors, and there's FFAR2, FFAR3, GPR109A, there's GPR41, and isobutyrate has actually been shown to stimulate the exact same receptors. And some studies have shown that isobutyrate actually stimulates GPR41 better than butyrate. So it looks like there's plenty of evidence to suggest that humans don't need to make a whole bunch of butyrate, both because in ketosis you can use beta-hydroxybutyrate from the circulation directly, and that the other short-chain fatty acids can serve as an intermediary fuel or as an alternate fuel, and might even be higher octane because they have the same effects in the gut that triggering all the same receptors. So that's pretty fascinating, isn't it? That like you can do all these same things without plant fiber.
It is fascinating. It is fascinating. I will say, having patients who do all sorts of diets across the board, I find that, and this is what we were talking about this before we came on.
Let's talk about it.
I think that I don't think there's one right diet for every single human out there. I think there are many variations of diets that could be right for different people. But what happens, I think, a lot of times is that, you know, for example, I've had vegan patients who are orthodoxly vegan, you know, and it could be for environmental reasons, which I understand, or you know, whatever.
No. The environmental vegan argument makes no sense. Like that has been debunked multiple times over.
If we go back to that, one big piece of the climate change that people don't really talk about is the role of glyphosate and these pesticides in causing global warming by releasing methane from the soil.
That's interesting.
So it's, so you could say that cow farming is not necessarily the biggest source of methane, which we know is like 30 times as powerful greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide. But I digress. Where was I before?
Before we jumped on the podcast, you actually had an anecdote about it. I would love to hear your experiences with vegan patients before we jump on the podcast, you had an anecdote about a vegan patient that was interesting. And then I would love to hear some of
this
your
actually,
overall.
I've seen this over and over actually. And what's really cool is that I've been in practice now for 20 years, my own practice for 15 years. So, and I've had a chance to see patients across many years of their lives, and I've seen it many times over where a vegan patient was not feeling well. And unfortunately, I can't convince all of them. But some, when you do convince them to start allowing some animal protein back into the diet, that unrelenting fatigue that they were pushing against goes away. And it's just that plant protein is not the most efficient way to get amino acids. It takes a lot of enzyme work to be able to break down plant proteins and extract the nutrition from them. I mean, even if we look at like omega-3 fatty acids, EPA and DHA, plant sources are higher up in the metabolic pathway with linoleic and linolenic acid. And not everyone has a genetic ability to convert that efficiently into EPA and DHA. which are the anti-inflammatory and omega-3s that are good for the heart and also good for the brain. So, you know, animal sources are a much more efficient source for a lot of these nutrients. And I've seen over the years, vegans who have started eating, in fact, one of them is a patient of mine who had a vegan blog and a vegan page on Instagram for many years. She became iron deficient. Mm. Put her back to eating meat. Now, this is sustainably raised, like grass-fed or sure. wild meats like bison, and her energy came up. Her iron levels improved because there's no other more efficient source of iron than from red meat. And she started feeling great. It did not make her followers happy, and she definitely had some followers who got really upset because she was known for being a champion of veganism and suddenly came out and said, hey, this didn't quite work for me.
There are numerous examples like that. In the future, I'm going to have Elise Parker on my podcast and Tim Sheaf, who are both well-known vegans that, I mean, Elise had over 1 million followers between YouTube and Instagram, and she had the same experience. She had anovulation or menstrual irregularities, no libido, low energy, brain fog. And within a few days of beginning to incorporate fish, she felt much better. And then comically, like many vegans are doing now, they go full carnivore. So she went full carnivore and is doing so much better. And Tim is the same. Tim is an amazing story. So Tim Sheaf was in the Game Changers movie and he asked them to take him out of it. He said, don't use any of my parts, take me out, because he started eating meat and had immediate return of vitality, libido. There's this,
as a doctor, I've experimented with different diets over the years. And I'm gluten-free for one. I figured out that gluten is inflammatory for my body, and I mostly have to be dairy-free because dairy, for me, weakens my immune system and makes me more susceptible to colds, even though I love dairy products, so I kind of miss them. But
most people do. They're like addictive.
But I've gone through cycles. Actually, last summer, I did a cycle where I went pescatarian. And I was a vegan pescatarian. I was trying that out for a little bit. And I honestly did not feel well. I did that for about 4 weeks. And partly it was hard to plan to have as much fish protein as I need. Like, it's not always accessible at lunchtime, although I can get wild salmon or steelhead here, which is nice. But then I noticed that, you know, after 4 weeks, I decided, okay, I need to go back to eating animal protein. And I always get, like we talked about this, like grass-fed, farm-raised, hormone-free, antibiotic-free. But immediately I felt better. Now, like, I don't go full, I'm not full carnivore, but I've
not yet.
Over the years. No, I love salad. I could never give up my fair. Salad, it's my fair. Vegetables. I love my plant fibers too. But I'm somewhere in the middle.
Sure.
You know, I'm kind of like a paleo, and I'm also Cuban, so I love rice. I wouldn't be able to give up rice. So I can't go full paleo and be grain free. But for some reason, you know, because I grew up with rice, when I eat rice, it feels really good for my body. Like, and I can tell my body reacts really well to having some rice. I don't have extreme, but
yeah. One of the things that I talk about in my book, which is coming in the next couple months, is that there are a variety of toxins in plants. And I think that there is a genetic variation in terms of what every individual is going to be able to tolerate. So I don't think every person on the planet needs to do a full carnivore diet to thrive. I think that a full carnivore diet is going to make most people feel really good. But I think that there is genetic variation in terms of what plants we can add on top of that. Some people might be able to tolerate more than others, but part of my message, which my listeners will be quite familiar with, is that, you know, you can go full carnivore for a little bit of time as a cleanse. If you want to bring back the plant foods, you can, but that there's no real detriment to removing them completely long term. We can get the nutrients we need.
Now, here's a kind of a little interesting twist to that, is thinking that, you know, maybe there is a certain microbiome that we evolve with, you know, depending on where you grow up, what your eating patterns are. I mean, we know there are regional microbiomes, like the microbiome in Japan is different from the microbiome in the Middle East. There's going to be a lot of overlap, but there's going to be some variations in the predominance of which species tend to predominate depending on the region. But the other thing that I heard, which I thought was really fascinating, I've only heard one scientist lecture on this, is that we're producing secretory IgAs that interact with the bacteria in the gut and actually go out, grab a bacteria, and then bring it in. And it's creating this communication with our immune system. And that's part of how the bacteria regulate and create tolerance. But that the bacteria that can actually cling to the lining of the gut is partly genetically determined by you.
Interesting.
By your own genetics and by your secretory IgA. And so I've only heard one person speak about this, and it was in reference to like peanut allergy and kind of looking at the microbial influence. Like we've heard studies where by changing the microbiome, you can actually get rid of a peanut allergy, which is quite fascinating. But I would say that it's partly genetics and partly probably the makeup of the microbiome of the person will determine what type of carbohydrate plant foods they can tolerate and which ones don't really jive with their system. Like I can eat, I mean, you don't see me here, but I've always been kind of, ever since, I guess you kind of can't see with this, but I'm a pretty thin guy.
Yeah, you're a fit guy.
I can eat white rice on occasion and I don't gain weight. It doesn't cause me to gain any weight. And really what helps me put on muscle is to eat protein.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's so interesting that the variability between people and the response to carbohydrates. It's fascinating. And I think that we're learning here. I think that there may be some people who don't respond well to higher levels of fat and higher levels of ketosis. And definitely,
there's definitely a spectrum there. And I think also there is a male female difference as well.
I'm not sure that I would be careful with that characterization. I guess I'm assuming what you're saying, but I've not seen across the board gender differences in terms of response to ketosis. But I have seen individual variations and things like that. I mean, so many people, I guess what I'm cautious against is that so many people will try and say women can't do keto or low carb. And I think that's completely false. Would you agree or disagree with that? What's your take on that?
I'm going to disagree. I think that women are not going to be as healthy long-term doing long-term keto.
Hmm.
They can do keto induction, but I think they need to introduce some starches or some, you know, complex starches.
Why do you think
that? At some point, metabolic flexibility. Because they still need, women need fat, you know, so they need some level of fat in their body in order to be able to create the right balance of estrogen and progesterone.
Why does that preclude doing a ketogenic diet? I think women can maintain a very healthy body composition with enough fat on a ketogenic in a low carb state.
See, that hasn't been what I've seen in my practice, that women who we put on ketosis will lose weight initially and then they'll stop and they'll plateau and their body won't want to continue losing weight. And it may be, and of course here it could be a matter of how is the ketosis being done. So are they maybe eating too much fat, not enough protein, you know, so it may be a matter of adjusting the macronutrients.
Right.
But I'm also a big believer in rotating complex starches after at least a period of ketosis. Once your body is in basically metabolically flexible, there is a point where you can start to rotate some carbohydrates in.
Well, yeah, I think that the idea of metabolic flexibility gets talked about a lot. People don't often clarify it. But what I think of a metabolic flexibility is going from being the carbohydrate burning individuals that we've been our whole lives in Western society to developing a fat-based metabolism. And so I think that once you have done some period of a fat-based metabolism, yeah, you can go back and forth. I don't think that I've seen any evidence that if you stay in ketosis, you lose the ability to digest carbohydrates. I've never seen any evidence to that. Some people seem to say, if you don't eat carbs, you're going to become metabolically inflexible and all you're going to digest or all you're going to run on is protein. That's been shown in any studies that I'm aware of.
Well, we know that enzymes are being produced by our genes, right? And genes are inducible.
Sure.
You know, for example, like we know that phase one detox enzymes in the liver are inducible to the degree of 500 times. So they can be upregulated really high if we need to, and then they can be downregulated. So I think the same thing happens with enzyme production. And if we talk a little bit about gut, I didn't even say I'm a gut health expert. I didn't even introduce that to people, but an author of book back there, Happy Gut. If we start to think about one of the things that I very commonly see that people can't digest protein, right? They just don't digest protein properly. And we know the most important part of the protein digestion process happens in the stomach.
Sure.
With hydrochloric acid. And what is probably, if not the top, but the second most common medication prescribed all around the world? Proton pump inhibitors.
Sure. Bad news. Super bad news.
Which are limiting our ability. But I think the other thing that no one really talks about is vagal nerve malfunction.
Sure.
Dysfunction, which then leads to low secretion of stomach acid because we rely on the pulsation of the vagal nerve to stimulate all the digestive processes in the gut, including the creation of digestive enzymes. So I think enzymes are inducible, but I think the problem with, I agree with you, you don't lose your ability to digest carbohydrates.
Because we always have glucose. You know, even in ketosis, you have glucose. There's always glucose.
Yeah,
there's always glycolysis happening, you know? It's not like we lose the ability to digest, to use glucose.
Yeah, we're not, you don't lose that ability, but what I see that happens with a lot of people is that the stress that they live under is what's really inhibiting their ability to digest and process food and extract the nutrients that they need from their food, especially protein, which is rich in amino acids.
They all need to be going for runs on Randall Island with you and jumping in lakes and rivers.
Oh my God, yeah.
So what I've seen generally with women,
de-stress.
So what I've seen with women is that they often, like you're suggesting, will do the mac. They might need to adjust the macros in ketosis, and I'm open to the fact that there may be some adjustments there. But I think that they may, if they go too high fat, not enough protein, in ketosis, so many times people go too little protein, or they restrict calories so much that they become hypocaloric. And we know that when you calorie restrict anyone, a man or a woman, all the sex hormones plummet. And I think in women, we have this overt demonstration of proper hormone
cycle. And it's got to be the right calories.
Yeah, too. It does. Yeah. In women, we have this overt cycling of hormones every month with a menstrual cycle, but in men, we don't really see it. So I've definitely seen men on ketogenic diets limit their calories too much by doing one meal a day, and their testosterone will drop. And within a few days of eating twice a day or coming back, it'll triple. I've seen it triple, go from 300 to 900 in terms of a total. And I think the same thing is maybe happening with women, is that they're over-restricting calories on a ketogenic diet because it can be so satiating. But it's a case-to-case basis.
There is a circadian rhythm to the gut microbiome.
Well, that's interesting.
And they've actually shown that there are different bacteria that are predominant at different hours of the day.
Oh, I think I've heard about this, yeah.
And so there's different bacteria that are feeding on different types of foods at different hours of the day. So it would make sense that if you're over restricting, that maybe you're not feeding the right bacteria that are going to produce the metabolic byproducts that are going to help kind of support your body in those processes. And the other thing that's really fascinating with that is that I've seen, and they've done in my studies where they've basically induced a false change in their circadian rhythm. So basically, I think it was done in Israel, and they use light changes to basically make it seem like they had traveled from Tel Aviv to San Francisco, stayed for 3 days, and then came back by using the light and dark cycle. And what they found is that those circadian rhythm changes that happen with jet lag cause shifts in the microbiome. And this, so I want to introduce this, because then you see people, and you could argue, you know, when people travel, they might eat more junk food. But I have patients who travel the world. You know, they go from New York to Hong Kong, back to New York, London. And what I found is that across the board, these patients have a lot of, they struggle with their weight.
Oh, yeah, I don't doubt it.
And they put on weight. And what they showed in this study with the mice is where they induce false jet lag and cause these rapid circadian changes. They found that their microbiome shifted to a microbiome that scrambled their insulin and caused more fat deposition and weight gain in the middle. I think that's kind of a really interesting variable
that's super
to introduce
fascinating.
Here.
Yeah,
you know, because without a change in diet, that you could actually cause weight gain by these rapid circadian, by scrambling your circadian rhythm.
It's, I guess, from an evolutionary perspective, it's completely discordant to think about us traveling beyond time zones, to moving any faster than 3 to 6 miles an hour ever, you know? So I think that's fascinating. And what you bring up is quite germane for people who might be doing one meal a day. What if, I mean, these are all big questions that are still hypothesis, but what if you're eating one meal a day and your microbiome isn't ready for it, or isn't adapt, you know, like, maybe if you're eating one meal a day and your microbiome isn't shifted properly for that, who knows? Maybe your microbiome
And the other thing, so I'm going to go back to the Hadza.
Yeah.
Because this is also really fascinating. They looked at their seasonal microbiome. You know, because we think of, like, you have a certain microbiome, and we talked about how, you know, different diets could shift the microbiome. Well, depending on the season, their microbiome shifted, and certain bacteria seemed to almost completely disappear. And when they went back to eating the food of the following season, so maybe there's a different diet depending on dry season versus rainy season. So they did, I think they looked at twice a year, you know, depending on what season it was. And there were certain lineages that seemed to disappear. When they started eating the foods that would promote them, they came back.
Yeah,
I thought that's really fascinating, because it just shows you that even the microbiome could hide from us. But the biggest impact to the biodiversity of the microbiome, more than dietary changes and whatnot, is really I would argue, first of all, the overprescribing of antibiotics.
Probably, yeah.
And what's even scarier is the fact that if you go to Mexico, or if you go to Thailand, Southeast Asia, you can buy fluoroquinolone antibiotics over the counter without a prescription.
That's scary.
But then the other thing I would argue is the other insult to the microbiome that no one is really talking about is the overpredominance of pesticides.
Yeah. Yeah.
Putting on our mm-hmm. food.
It's scary to think about it. I love that we covered so much in this episode. We talked about all these things that could contribute to diversity that a lot of people don't think about, like environment, soil, water, pesticides, antibiotics,
yeah, that either contribute to or takes away biodiversity.
Yeah. The other thing I've thought is spring water. You know, I mean, if the water we're drinking with chlorine and fluoride is certainly going to affect the microbiome, and our ancestors were drinking open water sources. And so I think that, you know, getting good spring water is probably a big contributor to diversity. The other thing I'll add is that in myself and other people who have done testing of the microbiome, or at least the diversity with like Ubiome or other longevity and stuff on a carnivore diet, we see some pretty good diversity, 85 to 95th percentile diversity scores. So there's anecdotal evidence coming in. We're going to get more soon.
I think you need whole genome microbial analysis.
I'll do it.
Which is not what Ubiome does.
No. It would be like a periomics, right?
Yeah, it would have to be like, there's some companies that are starting to come out with whole genome analysis that I think that's going to be the best way to look at the gut microbiome, to look at everything that is there.
Well, we should compare. We'll keep in touch, and I would love to compare my and your diversity, not like a competition, but a little bit of a competition. Let's see.
Well, my diversity was completely, I don't know if we're good controls for each other. Because my biodiversity, and this is really what got me into the realm of gut health, is that when I was a teenager, I was on at least 3 to 4 rounds of antibiotics every year for bronchitis, sinus infection, pneumonia, you name it. I just kept getting sick over and over. I was underweight for my age. I was tall and thin. And no one could understand why I was getting sick. The pediatricians thought that I wasn't eating right or needed to take a multivitamin. But really, it was my microbiome had been destroyed.
By the antibiotics. Yeah, of course.
By the antibiotics, by multiple rounds of antibiotics over the years. And I think also, you know, we didn't talk a lot about this, but we know that gluten and bread was a huge part of my diet. Growing up as a Cuban in Miami, Cuban bread. I don't know if you ever had it.
Cubanos,
you might not eat it as like a carnivore, but if you had actually, you know what the key is to Cuban bread that makes it taste so good?
Sugar?
No.
What is it?
It's made with pork lard.
Oh, there it is.
And I bet you there's no other bread in the world that's made with pork lard.
I doubt it.
That is what makes Cuban bread so soft, and it's so delicious. But anyway, I grew up with that. And now we know that wheat, gluten,
of course,
will increase the permeability of the gut, even in a normal person.
Yes, that's so crazy.
It affects people with celiac, obviously the worst. Then there's a whole subset of people that are not what we call non-celiac gluten sensitive. So they don't have autoimmune disease, but they're still sensitive to gluten, which is where I fall. And then you have the rest of the population, but we know gluten increases permeability of the gut for everyone.
I think that finding, you know, when I've seen those papers by Alessio Fasano, that I think is striking, because so many people get misled thinking, my doctor told me I don't have celiac. They had a tissue transglutaminase antibody that was negative, or they had a biopsy that was negative in extreme cases. And there's this wide spectrum of people who have non-celiac gluten sensitivity. And I would argue with you that
I would argue that it's huge.
That gluten is probably causing, I mean, the papers that I've seen is that gluten is perceived as a pathogenic molecule in the gut and causes the release of zonulin, which opens the gut, the tight junctions immediately in all humans. And so this is not a great thing. So
I would say that that's partly to blame for the epidemic of gut disease that we're seeing in our population, and probably also, you know, who knows, also for obesity, because we know that obesity is really an inflammatory disease.
Yeah.
And when your gut is leaky, it allows for one of the most potent stimulators of the immune system, endotoxin, that comes from gram-negative bacteria in the large intestine, to get into your bloodstream, and it triggers an immune response, but it turns on and you know about this pathway, the NF-kappa-B pathway. So it turns on an inflammatory cascade that not only gets your white blood cells all agitated, but it even goes to your brain and turns on that inflammatory cascade in your brain.
Yeah, it's crazy. I was actually just reading today some really fascinating stuff about LPS, lipopolysaccharide or endotoxin, that there are different modes by which LPS can enter the body. And if LPS enters in chylomicrons, that's the way it's supposed to come in, and that's the way we detoxify it. But if LPS goes straight across one of those leaky gut open gap junctions, it's very inflammatory. So we're always taking in some LPS, and we need LPS to come in. It's part of the natural process of pulling in chylomicrons, which are...
The problem is when there's leaky gut. Exactly.
Yeah. It's not.
And, then it's the white blood cells, or the immune system. 70% of it is all along the gut lining.
It's huge.
It's just waiting to see what's going to come just through and
pounce,
charge it up.
Just pounce. Yeah. It just pounces there.
It's kind of like our border patrol.
Yeah. Well, so thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find more of your stuff? I really appreciate, you know, your open-mindedness and your willingness to have a conversation with a carnivore and to talk about this, because I love having the discussions and showing both sides. And I hope people can take stuff away from this conversation. And I would encourage them to check out your work. Where can they find you in your stuff?
They can find, first of all, my website, happygutlife.com, and talks about my cleanse and just posting all the time gut-friendly recipes and information. But they can also find me on Facebook, Dr. Vincent Pedre, and on Instagram as Dr. Pedre.
Awesome. And you've got a book behind you. It's called Happy Gut.
Happy Gut.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. It's been out for now 4 years. And actually, it's crazy how it, so many years later, people keep discovering it and they're still really fascinating. I mean, the gut, I think the gut microbiome is a conversation that's not going to go away.
No, it's never
going a long away. Time. There's we're just at the tip. There's so much that we need to learn still.
All right. The last question I always ask my guests, I didn't warn you about this one, is what is the most radical thing that you have done in the last month? And I mean radical, like 80s radical, like radical. What is the most radical
thing? Could it be a little over a month ago?
Sure. Yeah. Could we
stretch it a little
bit?
Yeah.
I'll give you a
okay.
Pass.
And define radical.
Like 80s radical, like amazing, cool, like
okay.
You know, bodacious.
Right. Okay. I would say the most radical thing I did, well, I've done a number of really radical things, but I think the most radical thing that I've done recently, so it's within 2 or 3 months.
Fair.
Was going to Burning Man for the first
time. Awesome. Oh, it was the first time.
Yeah.
What was your like 30-second takeaway from Burning Man? We could do a whole podcast on Burning Man.
Oh, man. Burning Man is one giant flow state where you can experiment and understand how to use your intuition to guide you through life.
Sounds pretty cool.
How is that? How's that for a 30-second synopsis?
That sounds pretty amazing. I've never been, but I want to go. Yeah. Well,
oh, you would love it.
For people that don't know, I think most of my listeners will know what Burning Man is. And, you know, it's a collection of 70,000 people in the desert in Nevada. Black Rock City is what they call it. It's a big salt flat, and it's just a collection of people.
It sounds like the most adverse environment that does not sound like you would ever, like, honestly, I used to think like, why would someone want to go into the desert where like the environment wants to kill you and there's dust everywhere and you breathe it in. And, but after my first experience there and seeing what has been created, it is just amazing. You know, and the radical things were the things I did there. Probably, okay, so I'll tell you, do we have time for
just
one? I'll tell you probably the most radical thing.
Yes, please.
I went to one of the, there's all these different, what do you call them?
Camps.
Yeah. Camps.
Collections.
And there was one where they were doing something called the human carcass wash.
Okay.
And so basically in front of strangers, you got naked and then you washed each other, but it was done in a very organized fashion. Uh-huh. And the first thing that they do is they do a debriefing about, you know, you being naked, and that this is really not about being naked, but really about acceptance and communication and respect. Mm-hmm. And because whenever you went to touch somebody, if you were going to, you know, for example, rub soap on them, you had to first ask them, where is it okay that we touch you? Where is it okay? Where is it not okay to be touched? And it was such a respectful experience that it really, you know, like if you think about it, like we are born naked, like, you know, everybody knows what parts of the anatomy everybody has. It's really a natural part. I mean, if you go to other parts of the world, they're totally fine with going nude on the beach. And yet we have so many hangups about our bodies and about all the different shapes that humans come in. And if we could just, I mean, I just found that it really opened my mind to kind of a level of acceptance of like, yeah, this is my body. And there's been things about it that I didn't like and things that I did like over the years and, you know, like wanting to be more muscular or whatever. And, but then that these are all these people's bodies and look at them, like everybody's different and it doesn't matter.
You know, everybody's got their own insecurities. I think we all have insecurities about our physical body, this corpus that we inhabit.
Yeah. And if you can just let go of that and just, what if you don't even think about it and then you're just free? And then you can just be who you are.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And there's so much art. There's so much art and music at Burning Man. That's awesome. That's pretty radical, man.
But I would say that was probably the most radical thing I did. That's definitely stepping out of my comfort zone, which we talked about a little bit in the beginning. Jumping out of your comfort zone is the only way to grow.
I think it is. You know, I did a podcast with Chris Masterjohn a few weeks ago, and he said, everything that's valuable is on the other side of fear. And I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. That's like a real takeaway. I think that that happens for everyone. And so, well, thank you, my friend, for coming on. I look forward to future collaborations. I hope that when you are in San Diego or I am in New York, we can have a steak together.
Absolutely. Grass-fed. Grass-fed.
Yes, of course. Of course. All right. Thank you, sir.
All right, guys. Thank you for sharing that time with me. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Vincent Pedre. Pretty casual, high level, but I think it was important to have that conversation. I love respectful, easygoing conversations where physicians of different opinions can share those, but I hope that the information that I presented at Counterpoints was valuable. You can go to the show notes, which are always at heartandsoilsupplements.com. All of the podcasts are listed there, and you can see the references to the studies that I mentioned in this podcast. So thanks to Dr. Pedre for coming on for this. Like I said in the intro, the next 3 weeks will all be microbiome-focused podcasts. I've got Michael Ruscio coming on next week, and then Lucy Mailing, and then probably even more microbiome podcasts coming. So things are amazing here in Austin. It's a beautiful summer. We're getting outside. We're working out. Follow us at Heart and Soil Supplements on Instagram. See what kind of crazy workouts we're doing. See what kind of barefoot shenanigans we're getting up to here in the sun. We are living like savages and loving every minute of it, trying to live like our ancestors and really thriving, eating nose to tail. Send us your radicals. Check out the newsletter at heartandsoilsupplements.com. Send me an email, drpaul@heartandsoilsupplements.com. And that will, you'll get a response from me. I promise you. That's what I spend a lot of my time doing now is answering those emails and getting back to you guys because I really value it. And I think your feedback is valuable and it feels so meaningful to be able to answer your health questions and help you and hopefully get you connected with our supplements, the beef organs, the bone marrow and liver. They're so good. You guys, I can't wait for you to try them. Check us out, heartandsoilsupplements.com. And what else is going on in Austin? I think that's the main stuff. We've got Firestarter coming out. We got Blood Builder coming out. I'm going to Bozeman later this month for a podcast with Steve Rinella from Meat Eater. I'm super stoked to get in the mountains a little bit. Got a lot of adventures planned. So stay tuned, you guys. Thank you all for your support. Check out the book, The Carnivore Code. Check out blueblocks.com, BLUBLOX.com, whiteoakpastures.com, nutrisense.io, forceofnaturemeats.com. TheCarnivoreCodebook.com. That's a lot of places to check out, you guys. And last but never least, heartandsoilsupplements.com. Love you all. Stay radical.